On the program today, whence we came 1 year ago. Also, some retail and some housing, and then racism in the American tax code. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 23rd day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today a year ago, the 23rd of March, 2020, early on, as you know, in the days of this pandemic, when maybe not all of us understood how much trouble we were going to be in, public health-wise, mental health-wise, certainly, and economic health-wise as well. And we begin today of last year because we mark two milestones on this Tuesday. First of all, the stock market low of the pandemic. It's been basically straight up since then. Yes, I know, not the economy. Thank you. We offer that just as a marker. Also, a year ago today, the Federal Reserve said it was going to step in and start buying up corporate bonds. That was and is a big deal, the Fed getting into corporate debt. They did it because the market for that debt had just frozen. And the Fed was helping those companies borrow at lower rates, which can be conducive to business. And borrow they did. Corporate debt hit records in 2020. But with the rising interest news of late, as we have been telling you, corporate debt's been getting a little bit more expensive. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
Investors think about corporate bonds kind of like how they think about government bonds. If you're going to lock up my money for years, you better pay me enough interest to make it worth my while.
They want to be earning a rate of return that is higher than expected inflation.
That's Winnie Caesar at Wells Fargo. She says many investors expect inflation to pick up this year. People are likely to spend more, and that spending could drive up prices, not just for regular consumers, but for companies too.
It could be that a company's cost of labor is increasing. It could be that a company's cost of just raw materials and commodities is increasing.
Those expectations are causing corporate bond yields to rise. But there are also signs of an improving economy, says Kathy Jones, chief fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab, which underwrites this program. Jones says corporate borrowing costs are historically low, and even though they're currently rising,
that shouldn't be an impediment to them investing and continuing to grow the business.
The concern, says Stephen Davidoff Solomon at UC Berkeley, is if rates continue to grow into next year or the following. If rates get too high, he says,
companies won't be able to borrow as much to fund projects. Investment will slow because investment becomes more costly.
Fed Chair Jay Powell said today, although he expects prices to creep up this year, he doesn't think that will have a big or lasting impact on overall inflation. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As Justin was saying, and just because you will read and or hear about it elsewhere, Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen were up on Capitol Hill today, virtually, of course. The TLDR on that one, too long, didn't read, is that Powell, as Justin said, is still not worried about inflation, and that Yellen gave a vague wave toward tax increases, perhaps being in the offing. The biggest takeaway, honestly, the IT people at the Treasury Department really got to do something about the secretary's home Zoom setup. It's not great, I'm telling you. Wall Street today, not a lot of enthusiasm for anything. Really, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so get a load of this. The housing market might finally be slowing down. We learned this morning sales of new homes were off last month, down 18% from January, pending, of course, the usual revisions. And that comes on the heels of yesterday's news that fewer existing homes sold as well. None of that, however, is for lack of demand. Analysts say there just aren't enough houses, new or old, for sale. And we've told you about the lumber shortage that's slowing down building and driving up prices. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, wood is not the only thing that builders are having a tough time getting their hands on.
In normal times, Juan David Ortiz could fill an order for a new fridge or dishwasher in 15 to 30 days. He's CEO of Woodcox Appliances in Miami.
But nowadays, we're looking about 90 days as a minimum.
Even longer if customers want a special size or black instead of stainless steel.
I have customers waiting for over 6 months on a product that has not yet arrived.
Chalk it up to supply disruptions due to COVID and more demand, also due to COVID. Stuck-at-home improvers aren't the only ones waiting. A recent survey by the National Association of Home Builders found that nearly 90% of builders had trouble getting appliances for their new homes. The group's CEO, Jerry Howard, says that's slowing down construction and sales.
You can't finish the house and get a certificate of occupancy until not only are all the appliances installed, but they have to be inspected for safety and workability.
And it's not just appliances. Economist Ali Wolf with research firm Zonda says there are shortages of lumber, windows, and more.
Whether it's cabinets, whether it's doors, whether it's handles, all of these different components are harder to get a hold of and becoming increasingly more expensive.
And builders are passing those costs on to you. Wolf says 98% of those Zonda surveys have raised their prices this month because with all the demand for houses, they can. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Marketplace word of the day this Tuesday is overstored. Overstored. An economy that has more stores than can be justified by the size of the shopping public. The vocabulary lesson is prompted by this, a report from CoreSite Research that says retailers are planning to open far more stores than they're going to close this year. And we found that curious, given that a whole lot of people have a newfound love for shopping online. So why, then, would retailers invest in brick and mortar at a time like this? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra covers retail for us.
When retail analysts say the U.S. is overstored, that's because we have way more retail square footage per person than other countries. Mark Cohen at Columbia Business School says, to be fair, the U.S. population is really spread out.
But the disparity is extraordinary. It's 10 or 20 times what you would see elsewhere in the world.
So, okay, maybe not the best environment in which to open even more stores. But let's look at the retailers planning store openings this year. Dollar General, Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, sensing a trend. Also, Five Below, Burlington, Payless, discount stores.
Their business has been booming. They're taking advantage of enormous real estate opportunities.
Real estate opportunities because last year, a lot of retailers closed stores. Ricardo Belmar owns the retail advisory firm Retail Razor.
Landlords who experienced stores closing on them and lost tenants in 2020, they want to fill that space. So they're likely to make the cost more attractive.
Also, for certain kinds of retailers, stores are just part of the strategy. Online can't replace them. Dick's Sporting Goods is opening 16 stores this year. The company's CFO, Lee Belitsky, says customers can do things at a Dick's store that they can't online. Try on the clothes, obviously, but also
they can go into the golf simulator and try out golf clubs. We have hit tracks in our stores, which is a baseball batting cage that measures the statistics associated with your swing.
Dick's just opened a store in Rochester, New York that has a climbing wall and an artificial turf field. It's experiential retail. Yeah, that's coming back. Because we're all pretty sick of our houses at this point. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Should you be in need of business and economic news early tomorrow morning? David Boncaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. We talked Friday about my feeling that we are kind of, sort of, maybe turning the corner. Here is another indicator from the biggest city in this economy. News today from Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, that all city workers are going to be required to return to the office, that is, like, in person, come May 3rd. About 80,000 municipal employees have been working remotely for a year now. Thing is, with all the variants and a whole lot of people still not vaccinated and herd immunity still proving elusive, and just, you know, anxiety about everything, getting America back to the workplace is a tad fraught. Marketplace's Bree Benishore has more.
Herd immunity. In epidemiology, it's the point at which enough people are immune to a disease that its spread is basically stopped, effectively protecting the whole population. So if we can just hit that number, the country, businesses, could know it's safe to reopen. The problem is that it is not a magic number, and it isn't just one number at all.
Small changes in your assumptions, small changes in the way the disease is actually spreading in the population can lead to wildly different possible trajectories.
Dr. Samuel Scarpino directs the Emergent Epidemics Lab at Northeastern University. For COVID, predictions of what it'll take to reach herd immunity vary wildly. By some estimates, only 15% of people need to be immune. Other estimates say 90%. That range is so huge because herd immunity is a calculation. And part of the math in there is about how the virus spreads. So anything that changes how the virus spreads is going to change your answer.
So, for example, the herd immunity threshold for a population that is wearing masks and engaging in some measure of physical distancing is very different from one that is not doing either one of those things.
And all of this means that there won't be just one moment or one benchmark for when a given office can reopen. Dr. Gigi Granval is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
Every building is different and every workplace and procedures are different. So you have to make your own plan for sure.
So this ambiguity around when to bring people back to work is something employers are starting to digest. They are going to have to figure out what to do for themselves.
Often it's going to depend on the area in which the business is located.
Amber Clayton is director of the Knowledge Center at the Society for Human Resources Management, or SHRM.
The employer is going to want to follow state, local laws that pertain to opening businesses. They'll also want to look at the COVID cases within their particular areas.
Another issue is, of course, you know, how employees feel.
We've run polls.
Christopher Gavigan is founder of Prima, a plant-based health and wellness company. It, like many companies, is trying to take the pulse of their workforce.
And it ebbs and flows, world events, on the realities with this pandemic.
So if employee comfort is one of the main issues, one of the obvious things that will make a lot of employees feel comfortable is getting the vaccine.
Based on what we know, I think we will require it.
Legally, employers can do that. They can mandate getting vaccinated, according to Karen Elliott, a partner at Eckert Siemens Law Firm in Richmond.
But with a caveat of religion and ADA concerns.
Employees can refuse on religious or disability grounds. Again, Amber Clayton with SHRM.
Some states have actually proposed legislation to not allow employers to require vaccinations. Right now, our research shows that more employers are actually encouraging it rather than requiring it.
As of January, only 5% of employers were going to require the vaccine, according to SHRM's survey. 35% were unsure, and 60% were not going to require it. Those numbers may change. And even if employers do bring people back to the office, that doesn't mean back to normal. There may still be safety rules around COVID. Laura Stock is director of the Labor and Occupational Health Program at UC Berkeley.
Which might mean ensuring that everyone wears a mask inside, that physical distancing is possible, that sanitation is occurring, that schedules are adjusted so that that there's not everybody taking lunch at the same time.
But are we really going to still be doing this even when vaccinated?
A lot of these recommendations are going to be changing, but I think we have a ways to go before we can throw these recommendations out.
Which is all to say, the world of work changed almost overnight back in March of 2020. It will take much longer than that to go back to normal, whatever normal now means. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Birthday cards, those sell well all year.
Well, I mean, every day is somebody's birthday, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial subtracted 308 points today. That is 0.9%. Finished at 32,423. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ retreated 149 points, 1.1%, 13,227. The S&P 500 fell 30.7%, landed at 39.10. Amy was telling us a little bit about how the shortage of appliances is contributing to the housing shortage. Also in short supply, as we alluded to, not enough homes. In February, there were about 312,000 new homes for sale. The government figures that at the rate they are selling, that is about a 4.8-month supply. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy outlined changes to the USPS as part of a 10-year reorg plan today. Longer delivery times, higher postage rates. In its 10-year plan, the Postal Service says package revenues jumped from nearly $23 billion in 2019 to $28.5 billion during the last pandemic year that we had. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tax day has been pushed back a month. That you probably know. May 17th is the deadline now. Far less known, though, and it has been happening for decades, is the way the tax code in this economy discriminates against Black Americans. Dorothy Brown is a professor of law at Emory University, where she has been studying tax policy and race for years. Her new book on exactly that topic is called The Whiteness of Wealth. Professor Brown, welcome back to the program, man.
Thank you.
I want to start almost at the beginning of this book. In the introduction, you give a brief anecdotal open, I think, is the format you've chosen to start this book. And you basically explain why you wanted to write this book. And you say, and I'm quoting you to yourself here, "Tax law was about math. And I was sure I'd chosen a career where race had nothing to do with my work. I have never been more wrong about anything in my life," you say. Explain that.
So I grew up in the South Bronx. I dealt with racism every day. I didn't also want to deal with racism at work. So I thought I picked an area of law that had absolutely nothing to do with race. And lo and behold, I find race is everywhere, including the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay. Now, tell me, with that as a setup, tell me about your parents' tax returns.
As a good daughter, once I got my master's in tax law, I did their tax returns. I'm making the income that both of them made myself. And I'm thinking I should be paying a whole lot more than they are, but it didn't work out that way. And you know, I'm a math geek, so the numbers didn't add up and didn't make sense. It wasn't until I became a law professor and read an article that said, how do you know there isn't a race and tax issue if you don't look? Now, easier said than done, because the IRS doesn't collect or publish statistics by race.
Okay, stop right there. And I know I'm cutting you off in your story, but that to me when I read it was mind-boggling. I need you to say it again and then help us understand the implications of it.
Yes, the IRS does not collect or publish statistics by race. So we will never know if the tax law has a disparate impact based on race if we wait for the IRS, right? Because they don't give us the data. So I became a detective of sorts, and I would read anything I could get my hands on that would be a good proxy for taxable income. And I came across an article that said Black wives contribute significantly more to household income than white wives. Mm-hmm. And the light bulb went off.
Yeah.
My mother and father were both full-time workers and contributed roughly equal amounts to household income. The typical white married couple has one spouse earning significantly more than the other. That couple gets a marriage bonus. But Black couples like my parents, no tax cut. And for decades, their taxes went up because they were married to each other. And that's what the law required.
Now, why does the law require that? Is it because it was written by mostly white men who were inculcated in the white ways of finance? Is that the deal?
Well, that's the short answer. But
sorry, I guess I answered my own question.
Yeah, but how we got there was through the joint return. So yeah. Through a white married couple lens, where the husband worked in the paid labor market, the wife was a stay-at-home spouse, they got a tax cut.
Okay, so let's get out of the joint tax return and marriage and into some other ways that the tax code is systemically racist, I guess, right? And that's
sure.
That's, you know, it goes to gifts and inheritance and property. All of that stuff is different based on the way this economy works in the tax code, right?
Yes, and what my research over 25 years has shown is any tax provision that I've looked at, there's been a racially disparate impact. So let's take jobs. First of all, yeah. Black Americans are disproportionately found in jobs that don't come with tax-free benefits like health insurance or retirement accounts. But even when you have a Black American in a job with those tax-free benefits, they have different tax consequences or different financial situations than their white peers. So you could take two people with six-figure incomes. They work right next to each other. Mm-hmm. The Black college graduate is sending after-tax dollars home, whereas their white peer is getting down payment assistance from grandma. Their student loans are being paid off. All of those financial transfers received by those white taxpayers are tax-free.
Right. Let me just round it out here. When you made this discovery about your parents' tax returns and you got your mom on the phone, what'd she say?
Wow. When I sent my mother a draft, yeah. She said, they owe me and James reparations. Mm. And my mother has never used the R word before. Mm. She couldn't believe how unfairly she and my father had been treated.
A whole lot more people are going to hear about it once they hear about this book. Dorothy Brown is a professor of tax law at Emory University. Her most recent book about race and the tax code in this economy is called The Whiteness of Wealth. Professor Brown, thanks for your time, ma'am. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mario was talking earlier about retail and how many new stores are opening up and whether there's enough demand for all that to go around. Well, for today's installment of our series, My Economy, we called a more established retailer to see how things are going. Annie Lang Hartman runs a stationery business in Leland, Michigan. It's called Compass Paper Company.
We are thinking about pent-up demand a lot. And I've actually added quite a few products to our product line this year, just because we also have a physical retail space that's opening up in May. In Northern Michigan, we did have a busy tourism season last year, and I just, knowing that people are going to feel a little bit more comfortable being out and about this year, we have focused a lot of energy into adding new products. Birthday cards and kind of our love and friendship cards, which would be like, you know, cards for friends or cards for anniversaries, those sell well all year. But last year, our kind of thinking of you or sympathy cards just took off, which I know it sounds really bad, but ours aren't like, I'm sorry for your loss. Ours are kind of more cheeky and funny, kind of like we're in this together or just that kind of thing. So we saw a huge bump in that for direct-to-consumer, but also for retailers. So we've been sending out thousands of those. I don't see that trend going away, you know, anytime soon, but yeah, that definitely changed this past year.
That was Annie Lang Hartman. She runs Compass Paper Company up in Leland, Michigan. So, you know, we need you to make this series work, right? So help us out if you could. Tell us how your economy is doing. There's a spot you can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which is, to be clear, an endorsement. The new CEO of Citigroup, Jane Fraser is her name, sent out a company-wide memo yesterday afternoon. Effective Friday and every Friday thereafter, no more in-house Zooms, people. Go on screen with clients and regulators if you must. But if you need to do a Friday team meeting or something, get on the phone. The relentlessness of the pandemic workday, Fraser said, has taken a toll on our well-being. Tough to disagree, right? All right, we got to go. But here is your moment of economic context on this Tuesday. And to be honest, it's really more of a curiosity. Over the weekend, financial disclosure forms for members of President Biden's cabinet and some of his key advisors were made public. They are Googleable if you want to dive in. But here is my favorite. Jeffrey Zients, the president's coronavirus response person, owns between $1 and $5 million worth of gold bars. Just bars of gold. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufukme Batolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.